I can't ask anymore now. Well, it doesn't matter anyway, because it's just questions. And I'm going to ask the questions and Andrea is going to answer them.
So I'll have to ask you some back in return.
Yeah, you can. You can. But that's like giving you preparation. I've had no preparation.
Exactly.
I've not
prepared anything, though. I've just read them through, but here we are. Let's wing it.
Okay. So I thought that we'd start with outlining the types of diseases that we see in referral practice, but also in first opinion practice, that where we commonly use immunosuppressives. So, Andrea, dogs and cats, separate them out. What's the commonest immune-mediated disease you see in our population?
Well, I thought of this, the answer to this question, first of all, that's out of my hands, and I think that's got to be skin disease, but that totally is something not what we see at all. So in dogs, I think it really has to be IMHA, and I think that is the same that we see. That's the most common immune-mediated disease that we see at referrals, but also in first opinion practice. And in cats, I think it still probably is red blood cell related, but I would say there's a larger proportion of cats that present with a non-regenerative immune-mediated anemia, whether that is a non-regenerative IMHA or whether that's pure red cell aplasia. I think that's probably the most common immune-mediated disease I see in cats.
And do you perceive that immune-mediated disease is less common in cats? So let's exclude skin disease here, because skin disease is totally out of both of our comfort zones.
Yes, I would definitely say immune-mediated disease is less common in cats.
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting, isn't it? Because they get very, very different diseases, dogs and cats. And I know they're not the same species, but there seems to be a particularly big difference here. Because, as you said, not only in the types of diseases, but also the frequency, not nearly the amount of
And the same kind of thing as well is, I guess we see a lot of it in dogs in particular breeds, so Springers being a really common one, and I don't think you see that a breed specific difference in cats, I'd say.
And I think most of my first opinion experience will be based on advice calls, and I would agree. I think most of the advice calls that I get are about IMHA rather than anything else. But I suppose there is the potential that there's a disease that they manage very well in primary care practice without requiring any advice. And it might be that IMHA is just a very severe presentation, which makes it more challenging. Okay, yeah, so we're
I think the outcomes are much, much better in first opinion. And I think I agree with you. There's loads of cases that vets don't even need to call for advice on. But when I see a patient that gets referred for IMHA, one of the first things I will say in the consult is that once they get referred, I would give them a sort of 50-50 chance. And that can be a dog that's reasonably stable to begin with, because they can dramatically deteriorate whether that is their disease getting worse or the owner's running out of money, but it definitely becomes a worse prognosis because they've had to be referred.
Cool. Okay, so let's move on. What did I put next? I think it's probably about doses. So once you've made a diagnosis, what's your go-to drug? What do you start with, and what kind of dose in dogs do you use?
Nearly always glucocorticoids. I can't really think of any situations that I wouldn't have that as part of it, usually as a monotherapy, but part of a dual therapy as well. It would always be glucocorticoids. So if the animal's not eating, I'll give dexamethasone, and that'd be 0.3 mg per kg IV once a day. And if they're not eating, then if they are eating, then prednisolone at equivalent of 2 mg per kg a day.
Cool. Okay, and do you split that dose or do you give it once a day?
I usually give it once a day. I think there was James Swan's paper that looked at whether we should be giving it once or twice a day, and I think his conclusion was that maybe there's not that loads of evidence, but maybe once a day is a little bit more, seems to be a little bit more effective.
Okay. I don't know that paper. Great.
I think maybe it was just an editorial or something.
So they were definitely doing a study looking at that once versus twice daily.
It wasn't completely convincing, but I think maybe lesser side effects and maybe slightly better outcome.
Yeah. Cool. Does it
but also depending on the size of the patient and actually whether that's easy with tablet size as well.
And would you go up or down if you were moderating to tablet size? Would you round up or round down?
I think that depend on the patient. I wouldn't have a black and white rule for that. So if it's a patient that is larger, so over 30 kilos or obese, I would round down.
Okay.
If it's, or I'd use a different calculation, or but if it's a patient that's smaller or not overweight, then I would round up.
And does it change with disease? So obviously we have some immune-mediated diseases that present as very waxing, waning, insidious, not very bad, you know, presentation for IMPA, I'm thinking of mostly, compared with IMHA, where you've got very severe manifestations. Does your approach change, or do you actually just use the same principles every time?
I usually start at the same dose. I want to hit them hard in a way with that immunosuppressive dose, but I would maybe taper more quickly in the diseases that are less life risky. So the IMPA. So I might start the 2 mg/kg a day and then taper more quickly in the initial tapering and then more gradually later on. We've got a question from Dolores as well that's just come up about omeprazole. I think we've got questions about omeprazole, Dolores, coming up, so we'll get to those bits.
Cool. So I think your approach is in a little bit different to mine. So I think the big thing about immunosuppressive treatments, particularly in the acute phases in veterinary patients, is that we don't have a lot of evidence. A lot of it is based on protocols that have probably been used for a period in time. And to be honest, I've never really searched back to look at where those protocols came from. But when I was training as a resident, the most common disease I saw was IMHRT. I didn't see threatening ones just because of the nature of my residency. And we always used to start at a much higher dose. We always started with 4 mg/kg of prednisolone. Which we'd either split or give once a day. Mostly I split it. And I don't know, there's an enormous amount of good reasons behind doing this. But in people, and I haven't, again, not read extensively on this, they use massive doses in the first day or so. So they'll use something like 1,000 mg of steroids. And I've often wondered whether actually we should be thinking about inducing patients with massive, massive doses to really almost kill that immune system. But I don't know. I don't know if the outcome differences are there at all.
So do you think IMPA is differently?
So I would, with IMPA, I'd probably start on a lower dose. I'd start with IMHA, very severe diseases, I'd probably start with 4 mg/kg, but with IMPA, I'd probably go 2 mg/kg and see how we did. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I would treat them differently, but not for any good reason, just because of the way I did it, I suppose, historically. But yeah, I think the thing about using those high doses with 4 mg/kg is you don't want to stay on it for very long. So we would only use it for 5 days, 5 to 7 days for high dose, and then drop down to 2 mg/kg. So you have to keep quite a close eye on what you're doing and make sure that you're tracking that. So it is easier to start with a lower dose.
There's a really nice consensus statement on IMHA and treatment of it. And that's a panel of people that have got together that are experienced and review the literature and come up with statements and how strongly they feel about them. And one of them, they give recommendations of which drugs to start with and dosages. And I think their recommendation is prednisolone 2 to 3 mg/kg. But like you say, don't continue that dose for longer than 1 to 2 weeks.
Yeah. Cool. Fab. Right. So what about cats? Do you use different dose in cats or the same? Different drugs?
Different dose. So cats are a lot less sensitive to steroids, so I would usually go at 4 mg/kg as a starting dose of prednisolone, but I still would use prednisolone as a first line. I don't think we've got as much evidence, even just poor retrospective evidence, like we have in dogs, of using other immunosuppressants as widely. So things like leflunomide, mycophenolate, I'm not aware of them being used in cats and research for that, but the sort of second line ones would be different. So I'd use clarambucil and cyclosporin as the second line options.
Okay, fantastic. So prednisolone first line, 2 to maybe maximum 3 mg/kg in a dog. as a starting dose, and then the cat, what, 3 to 4 mg/kg?
Yeah, 3 to 4. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting. We always say they've got decreased sensitivity. And is that decreased sensitivity with side effects or decreased sensitivity to actually the effect of the drug? Okay.
I think there are sort of cellular studies that show that they are less sensitive, their receptor is less sensitive.
Okay, cool.
So I think probably both, in that it's how much they absorb and how much effect it has with regard to the effect of it with the disease and the side effects.
I think we all know that clinically cats don't seem to get nearly as bad side effects as dogs do with steroid, whereas dogs, you just touch them with a tiny dose and they're panting and not wanting to do anything and drinking and peeing everywhere. So it's quite interesting, but I think I worry much less about giving steroids to cats than I do to dogs.
Long term, I worry about it more, but you are likely to long term give them diabetes and pancreatic issues potentially.
Yeah, true. Cool. Okay, next question. So I think this is something that I think about quite a lot, because in people there's quite good algorithms. So you have a set of clinical signs and you're pretty certain that's what the disease is, but those algorithms don't exist nearly as well in veterinary medicine. And often we're restricted financially into the number of investigations that we can do in an individual patient. So when you're suspicious of, let's use IMPA here. So we've got a young to middle-aged dog with shifting lameness, joint effusion. What's the minimum amount of information that you would require before starting immunosuppressive therapy for this patient? And do you need a definitive diagnosis? How would you have that conversation with the owner?
I'm going to answer the question in a second, just because Philip's brought one up asking about the dose of Dex for cats. It's the equivalent prednisolone dose, so it would be 0.6 mg/kg I would give them. So back to the IMPA. So what conversations do I have with owners? I guess I'm in a different situation to a lot of general practice vets, that when an animal comes to referral, they're often ready to spend more and to do more involved investigations. So I would always offer a gold standard of investigations, and say that ideally we would like to do joint taps to get hopefully a diagnosis that there is inflammation in multiple joints, 3 or more. I'd want to do screening for infectious disease tests, and then looking for any underlying infectious, neoplastic or inflammatory processes that could be a trigger for this. Particularly that'll be imaging, chest and abdomen, urinalysis, and anything else that comes up and needs sampling. So that would be my recommendation for all patients, with the knowledge that in the vast majority we won't find an underlying trigger, and we do all that, and we need to be ready to spend that amount of money, but there's going to then be treatment on top of that. So if owners are struggling at all with cost, I'll go through what things I think are more important based on probably the history of that dog. So if it's travelled, I'd really want to do infectious disease screening. If it's quite a sedentary dog that doesn't really go out much, hasn't been exposed to ticks, then it would be less important. If it's an older dog, I would say, look, a neoplastic process that could be triggering this is more likely. Maybe we should do some imaging. So I'd base it on what the owners can do. It's very individual. And the only other thing I forgot to mention there is just hematology and biochemistry as well as part of the usual workup. But to do the minimum, I would say, well, if my hands are completely tied and they say we've got the money for a consult and that's it, I would just have to base it on my clinical suspicion of, do they have the classic signs? Are they pyrexic? Do they have that stilted gait? Do they have effused joints? And if there's multiple effused joints, and I don't think it's likely to be multiple degenerative joints or septic processes, then I would give steroids at that point. But ideally, you'd want to do joint taps at a minimum. And I think hematology, biochemistry and abdominal ultrasound and urine. Oh, God.
But I think it's really interesting, because we do all these tests, and actually, as you said, in the vast majority of cases, we don't necessarily identify an underlying trigger. And I think it would be really interesting to be better informed as to which test is going to be useful. Because as you said, the history is really important. And if we think of the triggers that we see more commonly, I think we get GI trigger. I think we get that type 3 IPA with the GI underlying relatively frequently. I don't know how many dogs I've tested for Lyme, and it'd be really interested to hear what the call vets say here, because I don't think I've ever had a positive for Borrelia in any of these dogs, but it may be regional. And I think there is more Borrelia in Yorkshire than there probably was in Somerset. And so that might be something that you look for more in certain populations. Urinalysis, we know these dogs can be proteinuric, and it's not necessarily very beneficial. And do we really believe that a urinary tract infection? I don't know. It's really interesting. Look at each of those individual tests. What do we really need? And I think, as you said, it's getting that contextualizing it. So in an older dog, you know, we probably should be screening for neoplasia. But if we find something, it's also about identifying what the owner might do with that information. And I think the big difference is what we then do with regards to therapy. Because the question then is, do we immunosuppress, or can we manage the signs in another way? Because it may be that if their signs are relatively mild, you might be able to manage them at least short term with non-steroidals or something else. But I think it's quite an interesting one. It's something that we do get asked relatively, you know, people say, I want advice on this case. And really, I always end up saying, you need more investigation, you need a diagnosis. But actually, it does come back to that conversation with the owner. What do they want? And where are we going to go with that ultimately? Yeah, but I think it's quite an interesting one to do.
I remember a case that was not that long ago, a 7-year-old Patterdale Terrier that came in with classic signs of IMPA. And I went through that same conversations. We could do the screening. I think there was nothing on the heme and biochem from the referring vets that made me worried about anything. The dog had a stable weight. So nothing else. And that clinical exam was unremarkable other than the joints. I couldn't feel anything in the abdomen. And I went through that conversation I've just had with you about the pros and cons of doing things, and they were struggling a bit with money, uninsured, but they went for screening, and we found the hemangiosarcoma in the spleen. So that it's rare, but that was removed, and then the IMPA resolved without any yes, it had a short course of NSAIDs after its surgery, but it resolved and hasn't come back, and now it's on lomustine. So there are the cases that you would manage very differently with as a result of your screening, but they're quite infrequent.
Right, so the next one, which kind of fits with this, is there a role for using a lower dose of your immunosuppressive drug if you haven't got a definitive diagnosis? So in those situations where maybe you're pretty certain it's got IMPA, in that its phenotype is similar to that, but the owners can't afford investigation, I think it's quite common for us to see on histories, try a low dose of steroids, so an anti-inflammatory dose. Do we think there's a role for that, or should we be using something else like a non-steroidal?
Is this specifically for IMPA?
Let's use IMPA, because I think in IMHA it's a less frequent dilemma.
Yeah, well, I thought about this in a few different circumstances, thinking about the cases that I've seen, and I think I think overall I think we have to remember that using a lower dose immunosuppressant, so basically that would be like between 0.8 and 1 mg per kg probably of pred, that is going to treat actually quite a lot of things. That it's a really kind of what we call dirty drug, isn't it? That it'll probably help with some degenerative joint disease, it'll probably help with appetite. There's loads of things that it does, so I don't know whether you're going to get a clear answer as to whether you're treating the right thing. So I would actually, in an IMPA situation, if I'm unsure, and we know it's a waxing and waning condition, it can have periods that it gets better just by itself, I'd probably reach for an NSAID in that situation. If they can't do any further investigations to try and make yourself more convinced of your diagnosis. So a short course of NSAIDs, but also counselling the owner in that this is something that we don't have a definitive diagnosis for. It would be good to try and get that. We might get an opportunity for that when it comes again, as it waxes and wanes, when there is pyrexia and joint effusions and pain, that makes it more likely to actually get your diagnosis then.
Cool.
The other situation I was thinking about was IVHA or GI bleed, which is something I think you can struggle with sometimes if you are limited with being able to do investigations, because you can get a regenerative anemia. There may not be all the classic signs of IMHA. Sometimes you can get spherocytes in IMHA with a GI bleed. So it can be very confusing. And even actually with all the diagnostic tests in the world, you might not be able to pick up on a GI bleed that's quite small and out of the scope of your scope. That might be a situation when you could use something like an Alicam, so the camera that the dog swallows to be able to view the rest of the gastrointestinal tract. But in that situation, when I've been in before, IMHA or GI bleed, I'd probably give omeprazole 1 mg/kg twice a day and be monitoring the dog very closely. And I would expect the anemia to be significantly improving and no other signs of a hemolysis happening in those few days. And then hopefully you'll be able to find your distinction which way the dog's going.
Have you used faecal occult blood? Do you use that?
I really don't. I think it's a test that is a bit of a farce, in that to be able to reliably get results, the dog needs to be on a red meat-free diet for 3 days. And often in that's the patients that aren't very well and don't want to eat anything, so I wouldn't be forcing them to eat something that I want to do for a test. It takes those 3 days, and then actually the result itself, I think, is reasonable, it's unreliable. So I would try and assess the stools visually to see if there is any signs of melena. But if I really was in that situation of wanted to find out is there GI bleeding, I think I'd go to an Alicam.
Cool. Great. Okay, so this was the question that we got from Mahalia, I think. Mm-hmm. So I've tried to break it down. So we've got a 9-year-old spaniel with IMHA initially presenting with relatively mild signs, so jaundiced and anorexic. So steroids were started on the first night and then it was pretty stable, but then PCV started dropping the following day. So from 19 to 16 to 11, he became more icteric and was unstable. Screening was unremarkable. So started at that point, nasothiazepin and a blood transfusion. And she spoke to you about this and... I think the dog got worse clinically after that point. You suggested that it might be due to neuroscience. Could you talk us through what might have happened in these situations?
So I think this is a dog that was very stable. Correct me if I'm wrong, Mahalia, that thing was very stable to begin with and then developed neurological signs. And we talked about the possible causes of that. And the fact that this dog had a really quite huge total bilirubin, my thoughts were that it most likely was an encephalopathy as a consequence of that and the effect of that on the brain. So a couple of things could be happening. I think this dog sounds like it had really severe disease. I'd question whether it had intravascular hemolysis with how rapidly its PCV dropped and it being its total bilirubin being that high. The other thing to consider would be, as it got worse after the transfusion, could it have had a transfusion reaction and just hemolyzed it, whether because of its underlying problem or just because it had a transfusion reaction? But that or a clot or bleed are still possible causes of its neurological signs. There's nothing else really that you had to give the blood because it was cardiovascularly unstable. That was a completely appropriate thing to do. I think it was completely appropriate to think about adding in a second agent. And you're right, azathioprine does take a while. The only thing that could have particularly, maybe could have helped would be intravenous immunoglobulin, which is a way of really halting the immune attack on the red blood cells. That's something that is not really available, very expensive and ethically questionable. I've only ever used it in a situation that was part of a study where we had it available to use. And yes, it can work very quickly. And that's the kind of patient that I would use it in that's significantly deteriorated. But otherwise, it's just this dog had a bad disease and was hemolyzing significantly. It may have had a thromboembolic complication as well. I don't know whether we talked about it, but I would have routinely started an antithrombotic at the start of treatment. And there's a debate which one's the right one that we can go into. What was the other thing I was going to say? And the only other thing about blood transfusions in IMHA is you're more likely to get a hemolysis of the blood if it's a stored and older sample. So if you've got a choice between one that's only a week old and one that's 3 weeks old or just about to go out of date, I'd choose the the newer one for the IMHA patient.
I think I would agree there. We shouldn't be worried about transfusing patients with IMHA because it's absolutely the right thing to do if they have clinical signs attributable to their anemia. But use a younger unit if you have one available to you. If you don't, then you know there's nothing that can be done. But if you've got one, then I would do that. And that's actually true universally. So all old units are more likely to hemolyze. So you're much more likely to get a hemolytic transfusion reaction in an old unit than you are with a young unit in any patient that you administer it to. It's not specific to IMHA.
If in that situation you only had one bag in the practice and it was quite old, you could think about doing a whole blood transfusion.
Yeah. You can
do. It doesn't give you as many, it gives you the other products in the blood that you don't need, the clotting factors and such, but it could be less risky.
Yeah. And as you said, there is an encephalopathy that's been described that's associated just with a high bilirubin. It's pretty poorly described in veterinary patients, but there is at least one where they used hemodialysis essentially to try and clear the icterus, and where you have got very rapid intravascular hemolysis, that's also a therapy that's been used to try and remove antigen from those patients by washing the red cells essentially that they've got and then giving it back to them with the assumption that the antibodies in the plasma. But it's quite a aggressive maneuver for management of IMHA, but that has been used, so plasmapheresis for management of both very severe IMHA but also the neurosigns associated with this high bilirubin encephalopathy. Most likely it's clot because that's what's common in IMHA, so I'd agree with you there. So yeah, we tend to start them on anticoagulants sooner rather than later. So what would you use? What would your first choice anticoagulant be?
Well, I think for the past few years, my first choice anticoagulant would have been clopidogrel, with the evidence that we've got that it probably is superior to aspirin. But I thinking more logically and actually thinking about how the clots formed, and so it's a venous clot rather than an arterial clot, actually anti-clotting factors are going to be the targeting the secondary hemostasis rather than the primary hemostasis makes far more sense. There is evidence out there that heparin and unfractionated heparin can be helpful, but it can also be unhelpful. So you could use heparin if you're able to individualize the dose, and if you're able to accurately measure the effect of it. And I think when studies that individualize the dose, the outcome is better. But in studies that just use a blanket dose and don't actually monitor it as well as they should do, you can actually cause worse outcomes. So if you haven't got the ability to do that, and not plenty of places do, then yeah, I wouldn't be using heparin without individualizing it. You could think about an oral anti-10, such as rivaroxaban. So that is something I think I probably will start moving to using. It's recommended in the ACFIM consensus, and it makes more sense in a venous clot to use that over clopidogrel or aspirin.
Cool. Yeah, I'd agree. I think there's some studies going on in the US, so I suspect there'll be better evidence soon, but the anti-10A seem to be the drug that we should be using. But it is interesting that we've kind of adopted this. Let's use clopidogrel aspirin from essentially cats with arterial thromboembolism. So completely different pathogenesis. We know that antiplatelet agents better for arterial versus venous, but that's what we do. Cool. Okay. So moving on to second agents. So prednisolone, we decided a first line therapy. You've got a dog with ITP, started prednisolone. What would make you add a second agent? What would you use and why?
So there's a few situations that would make me add a second agent. I would always, if the patient is reasonably stable, and that means, yes, there'll be some ongoing bleeding, they'll be becoming a little bit more anemic, but they're not showing signs of significant bleeding, needing multiple blood transfusions, they're not showing signs of bleeding in the lungs or in the brain, I would wait a week. And then if we're not seeing an improvement in the platelet level by a week, that's when I'd add my second in. I might add a second earlier if it was a patient that was incredibly unstable, so needed ongoing repeated blood transfusions, so within a few days because of ongoing GI bleeding, or if they were having hypoxia as a consequence of pulmonary bleeds, I'd added a second agent sooner rather than later. Or it might be as well, if it was a huge dog that was obese that I thought wasn't going to be able to handle steroids very well long term, I'd want to add in a second so I could taper and stop the steroids sooner. So lots of different situations that I'd add in a second.
Cool. Are there any situations where you wouldn't use prednisolone first line?
Things that would make me not want to use it would be a confirmed or very highly suspicious gastric ulcer, or that I could actually say is there on imaging, whether that is like ultrasound or endoscopy. So I might reach for something else in that situation. But
and does your choice of second agent differ depending on the underlying disease? So are you more likely to use one agent over another in ITP versus IMHA versus...
I probably am, and that's just based on what information we've got in our reasonably poor quality studies, often retrospective stuff, but that's all we've often got to go on. So in IMPA, my second agent is often leflunomide, and that's because there's evidence that that has been effective as a single agent. So if I need to stop the prednisolone, it might work better on its own. With IMHA, I might be more likely to reach for mycophenolate. Again, there's a bit of evidence of that. It might be helpful, and it acts a bit quicker than, I think, azathioprine and cyclosporin.
So I think historically I was used azathioprine because that's what we had available to us. But I think now I would... So IMHA, ITP, I'd probably try mycophenolate. I agree, it's quicker acting and seems to be, there's some evidence that it's useful as a single agent in ITP, which makes, again, sort of goes to that leflunomide argument in IMPA, that it might be enough in some of these stable patients where we might need to stop or get rid of some prednisolone quicker rather than sooner rather than later. So I think, yeah, I agree. I think it does make a difference, and we should be looking at evidence base for each of these decisions. So the question that we were asked, should we be using omeprazole and or famotidine, ranitidine as protective agents for dogs on high doses of steroids?
It's a really interesting question, and one that I think our answers probably changed in the last few years when we've realised and got more information about how omeprazole works, and that it also isn't the benign drug that we thought it was originally. So there's a quite convincing evidence that, well, there's loads of evidence that omeprazole causes dysbiosis, so changes the flora of the gastrointestinal tract. And there is really quite convincing evidence as well that if you give omeprazole and NSAIDs concurrently, you're far more likely to cause gastrointestinal ulceration. And that's because of the dysbiosis that's caused, and then making the side effects of NSAIDs worse. So I absolutely wouldn't use omeprazole as a prophylactic or protective agent, because you're just going to be changing the microbiome and the microflora in the gastrointestinal tract. I would only be using it if and when I had really quite convincing evidence of a high gastrointestinal ulcer, and that was causing profound blood loss. So if there was a little bit of melena or some hematochezia, I really wouldn't be overly concerned. It's if it's that is becoming a causing a rapid drop in PCV. And I know in IMHA that's going to be hard to judge, and also in ITP, but no, I wouldn't be using it as a protective agent. I'd be adding it in if I genuinely thought there was a change in the blood loss or evidence structurally on ultrasound or endoscopy that there was actual ulcer there.
Yeah, and I think the challenge there is in ITP that we often have melena anyway, because they have bleeding, which is almost microscopic. It's not necessarily ulcers that are large. It's almost like just
oozing.
And actually, omeprazole is probably not going to be enormously helpful in that circumstance. And so it does become tricky, doesn't it, trying to manage the...
Yeah, to be able to actually stop that ooze and changing the pH of the stomach, omeprazole just won't do it. So it won't act and help at all in stopping that bleeding, that microscopic bleeding.
And I think what's really interesting is I was never told or trained to use these drugs with high dose steroids. So as I said, we used to use 4 mg/kg of prednisolone first line for most of our IMHAs and our ITPs, and we never ever used anything alongside it. And so I remember being really shocked when people were giving these drugs. I was like, well, why would you do that? It doesn't work in that way anyway. These are drugs that help to cure ulcers. They don't necessarily prevent ulcers from forming. And I think that's a really important thing. It changes the pH, so it encourages a favorable environment for an ulcer to heal. It doesn't necessarily stop that ulcer from forming. So I agree. I don't think there is a role for these in protecting against ulcers. But having said that, we do know that these doses can cause bleeding within the gastrointestinal tract, but it's not normally clinical. So there was an experimental paper recently, wasn't there, that looked at high-dose steroid and what happened, and showed that in most of these dogs, which were normal dogs without underlying disease, they developed bleeding and ulcers in the stomach, but actually they didn't show any clinical signs or clinical effects of that. And so the advice, even with that being demonstrated, was not to do anything about it. Which I thought was really interesting. Cool. Okay. You kind of alluded to this already. Do you modify your dose for very big or very small dogs?
Yes, I'm very fat dogs as well. So it's a bit arbitrary, but over about 30 kilos, I would probably then switch to use a mg per meter squared rather than mg per kg. Yeah. I think I'd have to look it up. I think it's like 50 to 60 mg per meter squared for pred. And then very small, I just stick with the 2 mg/kg. But yeah, very fat dogs as well, I would try and dose on their body weight that I think they should be, rather than the body weight they are.
Cool. And then I think this is my last question. Can we vaccinate dogs on immunosuppressives?
You could, but you probably won't get an appropriate immune response. There are situations, I think I'd want them to be down in the what we classify as anti-inflammatory ranges before you'd actually get a vaccination that's effective. The other thing to consider would be titer testing, so seeing if they actually still have antibodies left and whether you need to vaccinate. It also brings up the question of, should we vaccinate animals that are that have got immune mediated disease? And I'd say the loads of dogs are vaccinated and don't get immune mediated disease, but you've got to judge the risk of it in individual patients, their risk of exposure to the things we're vaccinating against, as well as if they do seem to have a temporal reaction with a vaccination and getting an autoimmune disease. So I answered lots of questions then, rather than just the one that you put up.
Oh, yeah, I think that was fine. And then that was it. So any other questions? So I think you can see the chat, can't you? I can't actually see it. Are there any other questions? We covered everything. We haven't actually covered weaning from these drugs at all. I think we'll stay away from that for now. Conversation in itself.
No more questions coming up at the moment. It's polymyositis. So they couldn't take the biopsies. Yeah, so but muscle biopsies are sent to certain special places. They should consider EMG. So myositis, yes, I think EMG is a good part of investigating of that and being able to see, are there inappropriate fibrillations in the in certain muscles, and might guide you to the muscle you want to biopsy. But yes, it's definitely true that you need to collect the muscle biopsy under certain in a certain way, and then I think it needs to be frozen or sent very quickly, and there are only certain labs that are happy to do that and competent in assessing it. I've had a case that had polymyositis, and I got our neurologist Massimo involved, and he did it and sent it to the lab. So I can find out which lab he sends it to and let you know, Mahela, if you want. See Davies, it says.
So I think the EMG nerve conduction just allows you to decide which muscles are most affected. But I think they normally end up just biopsying the cranial tibialis from memory, because that seems to be affected. But have an EMG machine now, so if you have a dog that you want further investigation done on, we have the appropriate equipment at Paragon for but it's witchcraft. It just makes noises
and Philip's got a question about vincristine and ITP. Yep, I would routinely use it, and as early as I can get it into the patient, because it reduces hospitalization time.
Yeah, and I think that's the key. So you need to use it early. Don't use it on day 7. So you need to use it day 1, 2, whatever, because it just reduces hospitalisation time. By the time you get to day 7, the dog's probably going to respond to the pred at some point or another. Cool.
Great, this has been fun.
Okay, feedback, let us know or send it via an app if it's unpleasant. And topics as well. I think Liz is really keen to do something on back pain and managing head trauma and things like that, which she can do with Massimo. And we can talk about some common emergencies. I know we got a request for central lines, but actually it's probably not the best thing to discuss in this kind of scenario, because I can't show you how to do them. So we'll just have to leave that, I think, until things get more normal again. But please do feed topics through and any other suggestions, we can go from there. So thanks, guys, and we'll speak to you soon, I'm sure.
Thanks, Sandra. Bye.
Bye.